Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to ask you to welcome back Elizabeth, Kate and Chaz for an audience question and answer session.
All right, I don't bite.
Well, he's a celebrity. He's come from America. I think I should get the best seat.
Okay, I believe we have a mic runner.
Yep, for questions. Well, while we're waiting to find out who might be asking questions, I'll just start the ball rolling with a few questions here. Is that all right, Caitlin? Yep. Okay, now I don't know, of course you know, that the term gender identity disorder is now gender dysphoria in the new diagnostic and statistical manual. Do you think that that's an improvement?
I like it better. Mm-hmm. Oh, feedback.
Yeah. I did Latin at school, so I kind of leaned towards dysphoria, but on a more serious note, disorder?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy about disorder. I don't feel disordered.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's still in there, which we hope at some point.
And dysphoria, I guess, is an obstacle. People, it sounds kind of as though you need some highly specialised knowledge to know about it. I don't know. A rose by any other name, really. But I think gender identity disorder, I think. Hands a club to those who choose to call us delusional. I think it hands a formidable weapon to people in the wrong hands.
Yeah, thank you. Do we have questions?
Do you think it should be taken out? Full stop. Should it be taken out? Full stop.
I haven't thought about it enough, but I did note one of the things that in all the online abuse I was getting, people were using Elizabeth's the qualified person, but is it DSM-4?
It's now DSM-5.
DSM-5 is the current one.
Yeah.
And I kept getting belted with this DSM-4 stuff from people saying I was delusional, I was paraphiliac and so on, and it was a dated manual, and I just couldn't get into having that argument with people. Maybe taking it out is the answer. I don't have a strong view on it.
It's an interesting question, though, because if you actually look at any of the decisions in the law which have actually advanced trans rights, they always start with the proposition that it's a psychiatric disorder which needs treatment. And so when you read those decisions, they're all about that. That's how they start. So it's a question of whether or not our sense of being transgender has progressed to the extent where we can justify having legal rights without that substratum of a diagnostic or medical underpinning to having those rights, whether as a society we're mature enough to do that without having to rely on the concept that there is there's some underlying medical disorder which needs treatment, therefore you have rights contingent upon that.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that we've reached that level of maturity as a society to reach that,
You're quite right, and I have to accept the weakness in my own case as well, in that I am treated medically through the Commonwealth because I happen to be a serving military officer, and some aspects of my transition are funded because I'm deemed to suffer from a condition. My estrogen is paid for as a medical, I'm treated medically with that. If I go ahead and have gender reassignment surgery, that will be because I am deemed to have a medical condition that requires rectification. So you're quite right. It's a complex area and it's messy. I can't have it both ways. So if I choose to be treated medically, it doesn't behove me then to turn around and say I'm not sick, inverted commas. So, yeah.
Well, you don't need to be mentally sick, though. It doesn't need to be a mental
disorder. I would rather see it treated as a, not in a mental condition, but is as a physical condition, since the treatment is we're treated physically for it, it shouldn't be a mental situation, So that's where I think it belongs.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I think we've got a question up here.
I think I need the microphone.
I'll let you answer that. Since this is, this is your country, and
I can answer a little bit while you're thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess one thing that stands out for me is speaking up when there's the opportunity. There are plenty of times when there are comments made about people with difference, and to have the ability to be able to say something that's not okay. Because, transgender people, it still seems to be okay to openly mock transgender people in our culture. I think, that's the kind of last bastion. Everywhere else is a no-no, but transgender people still get it quite publicly. So, Kate, was there something you
and
wanted
thank,
to
add? Elizabeth, thank you, because you just actually cued something that I had forgotten. And last year I wrote in a speech that has become quite renowned, the standard that you walk past is the standard you accept. So I guess all I would ask of people of goodwill is that what Elizabeth just said, that if you hear someone being ridiculed or put down on account of that, that a person of goodwill would just ultimately look to the humanity of a trans person and say that. And my childhood hero was Robert F. Kennedy, and I think that he basically said that essentially when any person, and Lincoln said it as well in relation to slavery, and every progression of human rights as they've expanded has required the majority to see the oppressed person as a human being, the common bond of humanity. And Robert F. Kennedy, when he went to South Africa to speak against apartheid in 1966, said he flew across half the world to get there, and all he could see was the common works of humanity, tilled fields, homes. And he said from that perspective, there was so little really dividing people. And the colour of their skin sort of seemed so irrelevant when it was looked at in that holistic way. And that is really powerful and inspiring to me. And I just think that when we get into conflict with another person, we ultimately dehumanise them. And I think that's the dangerous thing about social media, in that a person just becomes an abstraction. And I've retaliated against my friends, my enemies, in the most vicious way as well. I've been demeaned by them, but I've also treated them poorly. And so I guess what I'd ask is that anyone who wants to be an ally just says, well, this person's different, but they're actually a human being, and we're all mortal, and we're all here for such a short time.
Caitlin, I'm going to get you to just come up and see what you can see, because I'm aware that the lights are in my eyes.
Oh,
yeah.
Hi. Oh. Hello. First of all, I think I speak on behalf of everyone here when I say to both of you, Kate and Chaz, that it's a privilege to have you share your personal experiences. So I think it's incredibly courageous, and thank you. I don't want to pry, and you can say that you don't want to answer this question, but I recently was reading a very heartbreaking story of a sports journalist in the United States, Chaz, Mike Pinner, / Christine Daniels. And it was heartbreaking to read that story where, he did sort of follow his brain sex and transitioned and was, it was apparently very well accepted by all sports jobs and his employer, but ultimately allegedly suicided because he could not withstand the loss of his of his primary love-brother relationship with his former wife. And I'm just wondering, when, you know, I know you were agonising Chaz, and I know that you were marrying Kate. Was that sort of one of the last incredibly difficult decisions to make? That that is that, you know, what you may lose when you're taking the next step.
I mean, I think, you know, for me, that was definitely, one of the things that made it difficult in coming to the decision and in that period of fears was of things that I would lose, including, you know, friends, family, partners, and I was pretty lucky in that when I transitioned, I was in a relationship and had the support of that partner. And, you know, we're no longer in that relationship. I'm no longer in that relationship, but not having nothing to do with you know, me transitioning. So, and I think that I probably would have been, you know, scared to do it had I not been in that, because I might have had that fear of who's gonna love me. And so, you know, I was really lucky to have that. I don't have that fear now at all, but I probably would have prior to it.
Yes, in my case, the loss of my marriage was the saddest, and continues to be the saddest thing. No contradiction in what I said to Elizabeth earlier, that there isn't a day goes by where I'm not blissful. But I recall vividly on the December the 9th, 2011, looking into my wife's eyes and telling her that why I had not been sleeping for 3 months was that I had had a recurrence of what I considered transgendered feelings. And to see more than sadness, rather to see a woman see her future go in that second. The dream of growing old together, which we've discussed many times, to see it go in a trice, I can still see it, and it hurts me whenever I think about it. It breaks my heart. She has suffered very deeply, and when people talk about my courage, I don't know a more courageous person than the woman I was married to. And the fact that we still care deeply about one another, and that she has such enormous depths of grace and decency that she still loves me and is a deep friend, and we have a pact that regardless of how our lives play out, that each of us will be at the other's deathbed, we hope, says more about her than it does about me. But that was the thread hanging on to me. And I tend to talk too long, but I'll wrap it up quickly. As I grappled with this, not one other thing held a terror for me. I thought I'd be an object of ridicule. I thought I'd be thrown out of the army. I thought I would lose everything. I didn't care in the interests of becoming the person I wanted to be. I was willing to put it all on the roulette wheel and lose it. Losing her mattered more than anything. And my therapist said, you're visiting the responsibility for your masculinity entirely on her. And even if you can cling in there and suppress this, you're going to end up hating her for making her accountable. And she doesn't even know she's carrying that burden. And so it was a real Sophie's choice, but in the end I did it. But it's the hardest conversation I've ever had. Chaz said something really very, very powerful and insightful when he was speaking earlier, and it resonated with me, and that is that he saw all his red flags, but with hindsight, that there were things that he now interprets as just so trans, but along the way, they don't, they seem to be just life stuff of various types. My passion to be a soldier was with me from that high. I'm from a generation of little boys who all played war in the backyard. Our fathers had all been to the war. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s. You know, most local councils would probably now arrest all the kids running around with firearms in their streets, you know. My backyard looked like Iwo Jima. So it was culturally, I was steeped in a culture where that was very much what boys did. And I think because I felt different, I strove to belong by overcompensating for that. I think my father's death young made me very vulnerable to wanting to aspire to connect with him in a way that I was not conscious of doing, but it was a subconscious driver. But having said that, I look back now, and Robert E. Lee was my honours dissertation subject, the Confederate general. And Lee, on his deathbed, said his greatest regret was undertaking a military education. About 3 months ago, I would have said the same thing, but I've returned to service this year with a richness, and on the 40th anniversary of going to Duntroon, I look back and just thought, whatever its foibles, whatever its myopias, whatever counterfeit reasons I had for doing it, it has had moments of great nobility, and it has given me life experiences that I couldn't have bought anywhere else. And there's an extraordinary feeling being a soldier on operations, commanding troops in danger for this country, that is very hard to explain to someone who hasn't done it. And I don't say that as someone who thinks they're a hero, but there is an onerous responsibility, and there's a human dimension to being a soldier that is very hard to convey, and I wouldn't have swapped it for anything. So whether I did it for the wrong reasons or not, I've been richly rewarded by... I've just wasted 5 minutes answering a question you didn't ask. I think I was predestined to do it. Again, Chaz said a brilliant thing, I think, and that is, I think things happen the way they're meant to happen. I think I was destined to do it. I'm glad I did it, and and I did it. It's kind of a bit late to ask for my money back now.
You know, I'll say about myself that my masculinity was always innate and natural, but I think, you know, the difference for myself was that it was also acceptable. And, you know, in our patriarchal society, it's much easier for a child and, you know, even an adult female bodied person to act masculine than it is for a, you know, male bodied person to act feminine. And mm-hmm. You know, and that's a sad thing and a difficult thing. And I know that, you know, essentially I cross-dressed my entire life but wasn't labeled a cross-dresser. And didn't have any, I mean, I felt different, and I fought my entire childhood with my mother, and there were definitely lots of people who tried to, you know, make me feminine, more feminine, feminize me, but overall, you know, I got away with so much more than, a male growing up in the position that I was in would have been able to, feeling like I did, and expressing their gender identity or gender expression, you know, the way that I did throughout my life.
He's right. I might just add one thing too, on a flippant note. I was too stupid to be a cop, and I wasn't pretty enough to be a flight attendant, so I...
There's a gentleman over here too, Kate.
I'd like to ask both of you, both of us, these, what you did is really hard. What qualities of character did you have to draw on to give yourself the strength to do it?
I can't answer this
one. Yeah. You know, it was a process, is the best way that I can describe it. It was a process for me that took a long time. I didn't have the strength of character originally, and it took time to get it. And for me, I guess it was a process of working through fears, and also of learning how to prioritize myself, and also learning how to care for myself, and not others first and foremost.
And Chaz and I were talking in the green room, and in some significant ways beyond our gender differences, our interior lives have been somewhat similar, and we both had difficulties with substances at various times, and the process of recovery from that entails certain things. Mm-hmm. And he said a very wise thing about, he got to a point where finally he did something for him and not worrying about what everyone else thought, and that took me to the age of 56 to finally do that. So when people say I'm brave, I'm very flattered by that. But what I did in the end, if I had to choose a single word, what I did was incredibly selfish in the end. And that took courage to be selfish and to be disapproved of for putting myself first in my own life, because my codependency and people-pleasing, it sounds, were very similar to his. And that held me back. And it's nice to be thought of as brave, but I don't think I'm brave at all. I think what I did in the end took ruthlessness and a self-focus and a selfishness that I found very discomforting, frankly. But in the end, it was life and death for me, and I chose life over death, and I don't regret that for one moment either. And I tend to make flippant remarks, which is probably a way of masking my true feelings, and it's a defect. But a friend of mine said to me, and I said it on Australian Story, you know, what's more scary, facing a 90-mile-an-hour fast bowler or wearing a dress? And seeing we've dropped an F-bomb, and I said, are you fucking kidding? I said, if you're trans, man, you're going to wear a dress. And, you know, being brave is kind of facing Mitchell Johnson, which I haven't done, but putting on a dress or living as a woman when I feel that I'm a woman, I don't think that's an exceptionally brave thing to do. What I regret is the cowardice that allowed me to live as a man for 55 years.
If you don't mind, because I actually do work with the youth. I'm I work with an organization in Los Angeles called Transforming Families. It was started by a mom of a young trans boy, and it it was originally just parents of trans children getting together to talk, and we've now grown a lot, and we basically work with the whole family. We're an offshoot now. We're sponsored by Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and one of the doctors there, Dr. Jo Wilson, and that's J-O, she's a woman, is I think probably the leading pediatrician practicing trans medicine in the United States. She's amazing, absolutely amazing. And so we meet monthly. We have a play group for trans children. We have a teen group for trans teens. That's what I do with a couple of other trans adults, facilitate that. There's two parent groups now. We just started a siblings group, and we've probably got, 200 families, and every month we are probably getting anywhere from, 3 to 8 new families in the greater Los Angeles area coming in. I found out while I was here, which was really saddened me just tremendously, that you can't be on hormone blockers without going before a judge. That's absolutely terrifying.
Actually, that's just changed. You can get the blockers now without going before a judge.
Okay.
Yeah, but you have to go through the court to get cross-sex hormones at age 16.
Okay. Yeah. Before 16?
You can't get cross-sex hormones before 16
before
at
16.
All.
Okay. Yeah. But, all of our kids that come in, at a younger age, automatically go onto blockers and then just end up going through puberty the one time, the right way. It's been, incredibly rewarding. I wish that we could become a national organization because, unfortunately, we're just in LA and that's really all we can serve. But it's been something that has been amazing to be a part of. Doing what I do with the teens, I'll say that I have, had kids. I had a kid come in, and he was FTM. He had been in a psych hospital, had attempted suicide, had a substance abuse issue, and I got to just watch, this particular kid come in, tell his parents who were supportive, who joined the group, transition, get sober, and go off to college. And I've seen that kind of thing happen now over and over. And then, every once in a while, our kids that have gone off to college come back and visit us. And it's been really an amazing thing to be a part of. All of the, and we also, run it that the parents work with the parents, and everybody who works with the kids are, trans people work with the trans youth and children. So it's really worked out nicely, and we continue to grow. And so certainly not enough, but some of the stuff that's happening with trans kids is really amazing. And these kids never cease to amaze me because I don't understand how they are able to talk about what I knew at their age but was terrified to say to anybody. And yet these kids at, 3, 4, 5 are able to say it, get their parents to hear it, and get, parents to get them to a place that has resources for them. Amazing. So.
Yeah, I don't know a huge amount about the situation in Australia other than anecdotally, but I've had contact from two families, one beautiful family in Queensland, and the parents are speaking at a conference tomorrow in Brisbane. And the father's perception is that in Australia the medical profession is lagging a bit, and that often the issue is seen that the young kids are being influenced by parents. Why people think that parents would think it's a bargain convincing their kid that they're trans when they're 6 and 7 is a little beyond me. But this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful dad found me on through interviews and stuff and sent me the most beautiful photos of his daughter, who is the most gorgeous kid, and she's 8, and she knows her mind, and she's just angelic. And I send notes back and forth, and the life facing her is so much more open, and the world that she enters is going to be so much better than the world that we came through. And her parents are just exemplary. They're speaking at a conference tomorrow, and I wish them well, because they're actually running into some hostility from a very ignorant medical profession. I'm so heartened to hear what Chaz has said about the situation in the United States. I think it sounds like there's critical mass there that can help alleviate that kind of ignorance. And I guess in the end, it's just the theme of tonight's topic, you know, that if there are high-profile role models who can say that there is a life on offer for people to live like this, then that's great. And I met a young trans teen person in the audience tonight who I won't embarrass by mentioning, but it was just heartwarming to see someone here tonight who is doing something at an age where I was paralysed like a rabbit in front of a spotlight, and that young man is going to flourish, and that's great.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for tonight. Please put your hands together for how wonderful guests here tonight.